All right, we are going to be in Ezra chapter 3 today. As I said, we kind of did the quick run over chapter 2 because of the genealogies and really just focused on Zerubbabel and Yeshua, if you really want to pronounce it correctly, as we like to anglicize everything. So we'll be covering all of chapter 3 today, all 13 verses. And I called the lesson today Grand Reopening because that's kind of what's going on. They're back in Jerusalem, and it's time to get the store running again. You know, it's time to open it back up and make sure everything's back to the way it was supposed to be. And what we'll see today is that even though they are reopening, even though they want to get back to where they were before the exile, that's kind of impossible in the current setting. They're never going to get back to exactly what was there before. God had kind of laid everything out for them. He had given them that blessing. He had given them the opportunity to kind of be that city on a hill that they were supposed to be. Really, when we think about us, it's a good little picture for us too, that we are not to do what the Jews did, which was we got all the glory. God's glory came on us. We are His people, and instead of shining out to the other nations, the Jews basically said, "We got them and you don't, so ha-ha, too bad for you." You know, that's kind of the attitude they took, and we're better than you guys, so don't even come near us. And we can get that same way, kind of insulated in our churches and in our Christianity, and that's the last thing that we want to do. So I think that's one of the lessons that we can take from it. And the other thing was, I was flipping through the TV this morning as I was feeding my son, and I'll stop and watch old Joel Osteen every once in a while just to see what he's saying, because I like to see what people are saying. And he's usually not saying much, but I stopped and watched him for a little while this morning. And if you've ever seen Joel Osteen preach, it's pretty much the same message. If you've seen one, you've seen them all. You're going to get blessing, and you're going to get prosperity, and you're going to get money and all that kind of stuff. And so he was talking about this morning adversity. And whenever you're going through adversity, the next thing that you're going to see is he even called it payday. God's going to give you a payday after the adversity. So you just got to wait on the Lord and get through the adverse times, and then it's payday. You know, and I just think it's such a destructive doctrine to put out there. You know, what does that do for somebody that's really going through suffering? You know, what does that do for somebody who's got family members that have terminal diseases and things like that? There's no payday on earth for something like that. So what does that do when that payday doesn't come? What does that do to your faith? Doesn't that kind of knock it down? You know, doesn't it kind of attack the foundations? And I don't know necessarily that he's, you know, antichrist and that he has these horrible intentions, but his preaching style and his message tend to, I think, undermine the gospel. And it made me think about what was going on here in chapter 3. Here are the Jews coming out of some adverse times, you know, 70 years in exile, being dragged away from their land, and they're going to come back, and they are going to get some blessings. God is still with them. God made promises to them, but this is far from payday. You know, this is not new heaven, new Jerusalem, all that kind of stuff that's going on here. They're not going to get that kind of payday. So if that's what they were thinking, you know, what would that do to their faith as they came back? So, and we're going to see some very different responses from the people as they come back. So let's look at our text, and then we'll get into it just verse by verse. All right, so starting in chapter 3, verse 1, "And when the seventh month was come, and the children of Israel were in the cities, the people gathered themselves together as one man to Jerusalem. Then stood up Jeshua the son of Jozadak, and his brethren the priests, and Zerubbabel the son of Shealtiel, and his brethren, and built the altar of the God of Israel, to offer burnt offerings thereon, as it is written in the law of Moses, the man of God. And they set the altar upon his bases, for fear was upon them because of the people of those countries, and they offered burnt offerings thereon to the Lord, even burnt offerings morning and evening. They kept also the Feast of Tabernacles, as it is written, offered the daily burnt offerings by number according to the custom, as the duty of every day required, and afterward offered the continual burnt offering both of the new moons and of all the set feasts of the Lord that were consecrated, and of everyone that willingly offered a freewill offering unto the Lord. From the first day of the seventh month began they to offer burnt offerings unto the Lord, but the foundation of the temple of the Lord was not yet laid. They gave money also unto the masons and to the carpenters, and meat and drink and oil unto them of Zidon and or Sidon, and then to them of Tyre, to bring cedar trees from Lebanon to the Sea of Joppa, according to the grant that they had of Cyrus, king of Persia." So again, Cyrus sponsoring the whole construction project. Verse 8, now in the second year of their coming unto the house of God at Jerusalem, in the second month, began Zerubbabel the son of Shealtiel, and Jeshua the son of Jozadak, and the remnant of their brethren, the priests and the Levites, and all that they that were come out of the captivity unto Jerusalem, and appointed the Levites from 20 years old and upward to set forward the work of the house of the Lord. Then stood Jeshua with his sons and his brethren, Kadmiel and his sons, the sons of Judah, together to set forward the workmen in the house of God, the sons of Henadad with their sons and their brethren, the Levites. And when the builders laid the foundation of the temple of the Lord, they set the priests in their apparel with trumpets, and the Levites, the sons of Asaph, with cymbals, to praise the Lord after the ordinance of David, king of Israel. And they sang together by course in praising and giving thanks unto the Lord, because he is good, for his mercy endures forever towards Israel. And all the people shouted with a great shout when they praised the Lord, because the foundation of the house of the Lord was laid. But many of the priests and Levites and chief of the fathers, who were ancient men that had seen the first house, when the foundation of this house was laid before their eyes, wept with a loud voice, and many shouted aloud for joy, so that the people could not discern the noise of the shout of joy from the noise of the weeping of the people. For the people shouted with a loud shout, and the noise was heard afar off. Okay, so we're going to notice that interesting mixture of joy and sadness all at the same time. That nobody can really tell if you ever had, like, I see this with my young son. Like, he'll be making these noises, and you're like, are you laughing or are you crying? I'm not sure. It's just this kind of in-between sort of thing. So people would come upon this gathering and hear the crying and the laughing. They don't know if it's sad or happy, or they don't know. So when we get to that, I think that's a really interesting point. So let's get through this. The worship of the regular calendar had to be resumed. And if you've gone through the Old Testament, you know about the numerous feasts, festivals, offerings that the Jews had, that they were required to do under Mosaic law. The altar that we're talking about here in the beginning, the first half of chapter 3, is probably rebuilt in 537 BC, about 3 months after the arrival of the exiles from Judah. So when they get there, they get their own houses in order, and then they go right to working on the temple and on the altar to offer these offerings. When we get later on, this is what's going to be happening. They're going to be so concerned with their own houses that they're not even worried about the temple. This group is actually kind of on the ball. They get their stuff set up. They kind of get moved in. You move in, you get all your stuff in, get it all settled. Then they turn and start to build the altar. So after that work is done, they turn to build the burnt offering. So why now? Why are they building this altar at this point in their history? Well, the altar needs to be completed in time for the feasts, because there are some big feasts coming up, and I want to kind of hit on all these feasts so we know what they are. And the people really want to make sure that these feasts get celebrated. The beginning of the new calendar year is about to come around, and they want to start off on the right foot. Okay? So, if you know anything about the Jewish calendar, okay, that's what it kind of looks like there. You can kind of see where it lines up with our calendar. Okay, the month of Tishri. Okay, where's my one? Which one's mine? Oh, that's not it. Oh, that's probably mine. Yep. There you go. There's that, my cool arrow. Tishri is right there. It spans our October and September. It's one of the most sacred months of the Jewish calendar year. It marks the beginning of the Jewish calendar year. So September, October, that's the beginning of the Jewish calendar. Okay? And this includes what are called the High Holy Days. Okay? You get the Feast of Trumpets, the Feast of Atonement or the Day of Atonement, and the Feast of Tabernacles. Okay? And such an assembly like this, this has not happened in 70 years. Right? They've been waiting 70 years to celebrate these festivals, and it hasn't happened. And they're finally back home, and they get to do this again. They know what to do, and it says if we could go through each one of those things and how they consecrated things, and they did things on the offerings, and they had it. Because all these holidays had, you had a certain number of offerings at specific times of the day. You know how kind of rote, memorized all this stuff was. And if we went to Leviticus and read those 20 verses, we might fall asleep, but we would know that in those 20 verses, all these things are described. Okay, so the Feast of Trumpets, that's the first and second days of Tishri. This is one of the only festivals that we don't really have a historical precedent for as far as it celebrates this particular event. Does that make sense? It's not something we'll talk about with Tabernacles. That celebrates a particular event. There's no real one event that the trumpets talk about. It's called Yom Teruah. It's the feast that called people to prepare to stand before the judgment of God. So it's the first step. It's the first 2 days of this whole High Holy Days, of this holy month. Okay, today it's known as Rosh Hashanah. So if you've got a calendar, you always see that on your calendar. Okay, Rosh Hashanah. It's the Jewish New Year. And so what you've got to do on Rosh Hashanah, what you've got to do on Rosh Hashanah, what they would do with these trumpets is, you know, they had these ceremonial trumpets that the shofar and all that stuff that they would blow, and that all these different notes meant different things. And so the trumpet itself is not a new thing. They blew the trumpet all the time for all kinds of temple things. But they would blow this trumpet as kind of a, think about trumpet as a warning, because this is where you were supposed to get yourself ready for standing before God. You're supposed to prepare yourself for judgment. So the first and second days, the Feast of Trumpets, you call people to judgment, and you're like, all right, in a week, you're going to have to stand before God. So you better make sure your heart is right. You better make sure you're doing the right thing. You better make sure you've atoned for all that stuff that you've got going on. Okay? And you'll see when we get to the next one. You've got about 7 or 8 days to do that. So after the Feast of the Trumpets, if you had anything that was weighing you down sin-wise, you had to try to take care of it. And when we think about our covenant of grace, how much cooler is it to have grace than to have to do this for a week and have to kind of go through your sins and try to work your way out of it to show that you could never possibly work your way out of all these sins. So then you would get to the first day of atonement. That's the 10th day. So 8 days after the Feast of Trumpets, we get to Feast of Atonement. It's called Yom Kippur. And you'll see that on all our calendars today as well. This is Yom Kippur is kind of like our Easter, in the sense that even secular Jews will celebrate this holiday. You know, if they're once a year Jews, it's Yom Kippur. You know, it's kind of like how our secular Christians will show up on Christmas and Easter. This is the one where the secular Jews will show up. They'll go to the synagogue on Yom Kippur. It's the holiest day of the year. It's the most solemn day of the year. It's got a 25-hour period of fasting and prayer. So it's a pretty serious day. And so, according to Jewish tradition, God inscribes each person's fate for the coming year into the Book of Life on Rosh Hashanah. So back on the Feast of Trumpets, you get your name written down. This is what's going to happen to you for the coming year. But he waits to seal that until Yom Kippur. So you've got those 8 days to kind of fix some things before that, and maybe he'll, you know, put your name in the good side instead of the bad side, and you'll have a good year. Okay? So every year, you're trying to get rid of all the sin. You're trying to get yourself back into the right spot. You're trying to get yourself on the right side of God, on the right side of man. Now you see how much work this is coming into it. During the days of awe, that's during all these high holy days, a Jew tries to amend his or her behavior and seek forgiveness for wrongs done against God and against other human beings. I can't imagine trying to remember every sin that I've committed over a year's period against everybody that you come into contact with. You imagine that? Okay, let alone the stuff you commit against God in your thoughts and in your actions. Okay, so that's the 10th day. Then we get to the 15th day, and that's the Feast of Tabernacles. Okay, the Hebrew word is Sukkot, or Sukkos is tabernacles or booths. You may have read it as booths in other translations. It's 7 days long. It serves as a reminder of the dwellings that the Israelites used in the 40 years in the wilderness. So what they'll do, and some of the devout Jews will still do this, they set up these booths. They set up these little shacks, and they have these specific materials that you're supposed to make these shacks out of. And during those 7 days, you take your meals in those shacks. And the really devout ones even sleep in there. Okay, back then, they probably all would have done that. Even today, we've still got some devout Jews that will go all out and stay in these booths for an entire week. Okay, so and it's supposed to remind them of what they lived like when they were out in the desert when Moses was leading through the Exodus. So those are our three high holy days that come up during this month. Trumpets, Atonement, and Tabernacles. Okay? And so, a little fun fact of the day. According to Zechariah, in the Messianic era, the Feast of the Tabernacles will become a universal festival, and all nations will make pilgrimages annually to Jerusalem to celebrate the feast there. So Zechariah tells us that we're one day going to go celebrate this, you know, when Jesus is back on the throne. And everybody's going to come to Jerusalem, and we're going to celebrate this thing. It's one of those things where when you read about in Revelation, you see that there's a temple going on in the millennial kingdom, and you're like, why in the world is there a temple there? I don't really know, but there's a temple there, and we're celebrating some festivals there. Is it purely symbolic? Maybe, because you wouldn't need any sacrifices. You know, it's been taken care of, but there is temple stuff going on at that point. So, kind of interesting, I thought. Okay, so let's get back to what's going on here. Jeshua and Zerubbabel. Okay, why is Jeshua mentioned first here, do you think?
He's the high priest, isn't he?
He's the high priest, right? So, Zerubbabel's the guy in charge. He's the governor. But what are we talking about in this section of the chapter? We're talking about establishing the altar. We're talking about rebuilding the temple. And so Jeshua gets mentioned first. So you'll see when we get to verse 8, They're going to say it again, and when it comes down to civil matters of getting the construction ready, Zerubbabel is mentioned first. So you can always kind of tell what the context is based on who's mentioned first. Okay? They're not fighting for headlines. Okay? They're spiritual and civil leaders respectively. The priest takes precedence over the civil leader in view of the nature of the occasion, and we're going to see the opposite in verse 8. Okay? Now in verse 3 it says, the people of those countries, and I think we could skip right over this and not know what it is when we read it. It says, and they set the altar upon his basis, for fear was upon them because of the people of those countries. Okay? These are the settlers who had come to occupy the land during the time that Israel was gone. You know, Jerusalem did not lay unsettled. There are people there. Assyrians had brought people in when they took the northern kingdom out. The Babylonians had brought their own people in when they took the Jews out. So it's not like they just abandoned the place. They actually repopulate it with foreign people. So when the Jews come back in, it's not an empty place. You know, they're still dealing with other people. So if we think about a reverse sort of Exodus thing going on here, when they came out of the Exodus, what do they have to deal with? People from other races, people that are really not interested in helping them serve God. And so they've got some issues here. And these inhabitants saw the Jews as a threat. They quickly wanted to undermine their allegiance to God. And when we get to chapter 4, we'll see a lot more of this. They don't want... I think what you see with a lot of these nations is they realize that Israel is a little different. They realize that this God that they're serving is a little bit different than some of these gods they're making out of stone and wood and all those kinds of things. And because they've heard stories, they know about this stuff. God is famous. And so they don't want these guys coming back in and reestablishing what was going on before. Because their grandfathers and great-grandfathers could tell them about David and Solomon and how awesome this kingdom was back then and how this could happen again. And so they don't want all that to happen. The exiles of Judah moved quickly to reestablish the worship of Yahweh in the land, something that never really happens in the northern kingdom. So what I wanted to mention on that is, when you look at the New Testament, what do the Jews in Judah think of the northern kingdom? Those Jews that live up there.
Dogs.
Yeah, right. They're because what's the capital city? Samaria, right? And we know about Samaritans. And if all you got to do is read through the Gospels, and you hear how they talk about Samaritans. You know, why would we ever associate with Samaritans? It's, you know, when Jesus goes through Samaria, the disciples are like, "Are you sure you don't want to go around?" Because it was dangerous for a Jew to go through Samaria, just like it was dangerous for a Samaritan to go through Judah. That's where you get the parable. That's where you get, you know, that the Samaritan was helping. That's really the big thing in that parable. You know, that these people that would never speak, would never talk, that's the guy. It's a big picture of the gospel, of how it's going to reach everybody. You know, so the idea that the northern kingdom never really does that. The northern kingdom just kind of blends right in with all the Assyrians and everybody else that came in. And so you get, they were viewed as half-breeds. They were viewed as not real Jews because they compromised on everything. And there's a little bit of truth in the compromise side of things. Right? And these Jews in Judah were always better at kind of trying to get back to Yahweh. They weren't good at it. But they were better than what the northern kingdom was. Remember, at least we have a handful of good kings in the south. There's never any goodness that comes out of the north. The north is pretty much taken away at that point. So just a kind of a look at here, the guys in Judah, when they come back, they want to make sure that Yahweh gets back on, you know, in the forefront here as far as the worship goes. So they set the altar. This is all you really need to do worship. Technically, all you need is this offer to do the burnt offerings. They don't have the temple proper, but they do have an altar where they can offer all the different offerings. And they reset it on its old foundation so it occupied its sacred site. So exactly where Solomon's temple was, that's where they're going to put it. They're not going to come up with a new location. They go right back to that same spot and put the altar right there. Okay? And then in verse 5, they offer something onto the Lord in verse 5. And I think it's really significant that the restoration of the sacrifices comes before the building of the temple. Okay? What do you think? Because, you know, our natural, we wouldn't, like, start a new church and start having church in the lawn while the church was being built, right? We would always kind of wait for the church to get built most of the time, you know, but they're not doing it that way. Why do you think that's the case? Or what do you think that's telling us?
And wait 70 years.
That's true. It's been 70 years, yeah.
So they're getting together to worship the Lord.
Right.
Through their sacrifices and not to just reverence a big building or
right.
just because of the big building, but their goal is to worship the Lord
yeah.
and to do what's pleasing to Him. And He has decreed that they would sacrifice to Him. So that's what they're
that's right. doing. Yeah, I think it tells us a lot about how this particular group has a pretty solid perspective on what it means to worship God. It's not about the building. It's about, let's get to worshiping. Let's get to offering. Now, the covenant's going to be totally different in the future for these guys. You know, it's not going to be all sacrifices and burnt offerings. But they know that worshiping God and offering to the Lord is more important than building the temple first off. They want to make sure that they are worshiping and sacrificing and singing praises to Him. And then we'll get to the temple. He'll bless the temple when He knows that we're worshiping Him in the right way. Does that make sense? I think that's the significance there in verse 5. They get to offering to the Lord first. That's the priority.
I think they're doing what they can. So we don't have a building. We don't have a temple. Right. There are other things that we can't do with ceremonies and everything. Mm-hmm. But we can still do this. We can still worship. We can still worship because we've got this.
Yeah.
And so they're going to do what they can, what they have the available.
Yeah, very much so. I think we could learn a thing or two from it with our modern comforts. You know, there's something to be said with all of that. Okay, so in verse 7, we've got all kinds of people coming in. They're paying masons, they're paying carpenters. They've got people coming in from Sidon, from Tyre, and they're bringing cedar trees down. And the process of rebuilding the temple sounds really similar to the original construction. So let's look over at 1 Kings, and you see if we see some parallels here from when Solomon built the temple. 1 Kings chapter 5. Starting in verse 6. It says, "Now therefore command thou that they hew me," I can't say the H sound really well, so, "they cut down me cedar trees out of Lebanon, and my servants shall be with thy servants, and unto thee will I give hire for thy servants according to all that thou shalt appoint, for thou knowest that there is not among us any that can skill to hew timber like unto the Sidonians." So if you want a timber, these are the guys you call. "And it came to pass when Hiram heard the words of Solomon that he rejoiced greatly and said, Blessed be the Lord this day, which has given unto David a wise son over this great people. And Hiram sent to Solomon," Hiram's from up there in Sidon, "saying, I have considered the things which thou sentest to me for, and I will do all thy desire concerning timber of cedar and concerning timber of fir. My servants shall bring them down from Lebanon unto the sea, and I will convey them by sea in floats unto the place that thou shalt appoint me. And will cause them to discharge there, and thou shalt receive them, and thou shalt accomplish my desire in giving food for my household." So Hiram gave Solomon cedar trees and fir trees according to all his desire. And Solomon gave Hiram 20,000 measures of wheat for food to his household and 20 measures of pure oil. Thus gave Solomon to Hiram year by year. And the Lord gave Solomon wisdom as he promised him. And there was peace between Hiram and Solomon, and they two made a league together. So if we go back to verse 7, "They gave money also unto the masons and the carpenters, and meat and drink and oil." Sounds a lot like what Solomon paid unto them of Sidon and to them of Tyre to bring cedar trees from Lebanon to the Sea of Joppa according to the grant that they had of Cyrus, the king of Persia. So it seems again that we have other nations who have no reason to help Israel, who have no reason to help these guys, but they are helping. They're sending these valuable cedar trees down from Lebanon to build the temple. And Cyrus, the pagan king that we talked about the first couple weeks, he is the one that's authorizing all this stuff. And this is not so much for the Jews. It's, you know, if the Jews had sent a representative up to Sidon, I'm not sure that they're going to give him trees. But when Cyrus says, send some trees down to Jerusalem, they jump right to it. Because Cyrus is the most powerful man in the world right now. Right? And Cyrus is sponsoring this rebuilding effort, like we've said before.
It's kind of interesting that they were still giving him meat and drink, even though they didn't really have to.
Yeah.
You know, cause it's like, hey, Cyrus said, bring those logs.
Right.
I don't have to give anything for them. They told them to bring them, but they still did.
Yeah, it's definitely, there's a,
kind of thought of it as they were, you know, it's still part of the sin thing. They got to cleanse themselves. They want to be pure, so.
Right. And they want to build the temple. They don't want Cyrus building the temple. Yeah, yeah, even though Cyrus is the sovereign, you know, secularly here. So I think maybe a sovereign God has something to do with this. It just seems like all the puzzle pieces are falling into place. Okay, so we get to verse 8 now. So all the altars built, the festivals are reinstated, and we get to the spring of the next year. Okay, so this is now the second year of the second month. So since the Jews returned to Judah in the spring of 537, the second year would be the spring of 536. Okay? And the month of Iyar, I don't know if that's being pronounced right, but that's April or May of our year. It's the same month that Solomon began construction of the temple. So they're going to build the temple on the exact same spot that Solomon built it, and they're going to start at the same time that Solomon started building it. Okay? They know their history. They know what's going on. They want to make sure that this is done the right way. God blessed Solomon's building of the temple. We want to do all the things the same way. We're getting the cedar from the same place. We're going to start it at the same time. We're going to build it at the same spot. And that's what they're concerned about. Now, in verse 8, just an interesting thing here. It says, And the remnant of their brethren, the priests and the Levites, and all that they were to come out of the captivity in Jerusalem, and appointed the Levites from 20 years old and upward to set forward the work of the house of the Lord. So Levites that are 20 years old are allowed to start working in the Lord. Do you remember what the earlier age limit was for Levites? If we went back into Leviticus and Numbers. Have any idea? It wasn't 20.
25?
At one point it's 25, and even before that it's 30. So yeah, depending on at what time period, it's 30 or 25. So we're now reducing it back to 20. So why do you think the age limit's being reduced?
Less of them.
There's a lot less of them. Okay. If we look over it, just look back at verse 40 of chapter 2. Okay, and you'll see this. Chapter 2, verse 40 of Ezra. It says, the Levites, the children of Jeshua and Kadmiel, of the children of Hodaviah, 70 and 4. So 74 Levites come back to Jerusalem. All the rest of them stay in Babylon. So we have almost 30,000 people come back, 74 Levites. Percentage-wise, you know, we're not doing so well. That's a lot of, you know, if that was like a deacon setup, we'd be in trouble. You know, there would be a lot of people to serve. Yeah, that's a crazy number. So 74 Levites, and when they come back for 29,000, 30,000 people. So what they do is they reduce the age limit and say, all right, well, we need more Levites, so let's start them at 20 years old. Okay? And then they can start serving. We need to do that.
I wonder if that's also because they're not being appointed for service in the temple. This is just a construction project.
True, yeah.
Which it's a very special one. But it's a construction project, so that's why.
Yes,
20 is the age of adulthood. Is the age for a fighting man.
Right, right.
20 and up.
Yeah, it's probably because their duties are probably a little wider ranging than just
right,
pure temple service at this point.
The gatekeepers or the standards
yeah.
or the other. Other
yeah. And if you look at the older laws, it says that Levites actually stop serving at 60. Yeah. So if you start them at 20, you get there's more years of service to be done there. They still do some things at 60, but they're not. They're not in the forefront anymore. Okay. So we get trumpets in verse 10. And when the builders laid the foundation of the temple of the Lord, they set the priests in their apparel with trumpets, and the Levites and the son of Asaph with cymbals to praise the Lord after the ordinance of David, the king of Israel. So when the foundation gets laid, it's time to celebrate. The trumpets come out at joyous occasions. It's with the possible exception of their use of the coronation of King Joash, which is in 2 Kings 11. The trumpets were always blown by priests. So only the priests are allowed to have these trumpets, and they're most often used in joyous occasions. And usually if the trumpets are coming out, these are not the ceremonial, you know, ram's horn kind of shofar kind of things. Josephus described it almost like a flute. They were like these little tubes. And so I don't know what they sounded like, but obviously they were different than these big curved ram horns that they used in the other stuff. But these trumpets were always used for joyous occasions. Okay? And probably a better way to look at verse 11 is that they sang responsibly. Instead of they sang together, they sung together by course in praising and giving thanks unto the Lord. So their song of praise is like Psalm 136:1, where it says, oh, give thanks unto the Lord, for he is good, for his mercy endures forever. So the singers would sing something and the people would respond. And the singers would sing and the people would respond. And it's probably where we got that kind of that pattern when we got into, you know, if you've ever been to a Catholic church, you know, there's a lot of you say something, then I'll say something, and then you say something, and I'll say something. I think the Catholic Church they really try to get back to this. I don't know why they want to jump back to the old kind of covenant ideas and the priestly garb and all. You see a lot of temple stuff in the Catholic Church. You know, the priests are going to wear a certain outfit. They're going to go in a certain order. They're going to say a certain thing, and you're going to respond a certain way. It's very much ceremonial. It's very much ritualistic. So the same sort of thing here. We get responsive psalms, and that's really what the psalms were. They were songs of praise. They were responsive things. You know, we really don't know how the psalms were originally. You know, the psalms were not published as one big book originally. You know, these are a lot of different things that are brought together collectively as what they would use in temple worship as they would praise. Okay, so they weep with a loud voice in chapter 12. So why are these men weeping at such a joyous occasion? Why are we crying when the foundation has been laid? What do you think?
Weeping with joy?
There could be some of that. Look at earlier in the verse in chapter 12. Many of the priests and Levites and chief of the fathers who were ancient men that had seen the first house when the foundation of this house was laid before their eyes wept with a loud voice.
Well, it's a rebuilding. They were there when it was destroyed.
Yeah.
Now it's coming back again.
Yeah. Well, and what was the previous temple compared to this one? Yeah. I mean, the previous temple was the greatest thing they've ever seen. It was maybe the greatest building ever built. You know, you think about Taj Mahal and you think about these different places. Apparently Solomon's Temple was better than all those places, with the gold that was in this place and the cedar logs that were in this place and the marble that was in this place. Just an amazing architectural feat. And then on top of that, you had these, I mean, think about the number of priests that were serving in that temple. Think about the sacrifices that were made there, the stuff that they would see there, the people that would flock to Jerusalem. And now here they are back. They're rebuilding, but it doesn't look anything like Solomon's temple did. You know, it's not the same as it was before. And so these older men that had seen Solomon's temple, the greatest thing they had ever seen, they're actually sad because, you know, all right, it's great that we're getting a temple, but well, look what we had before. You know, look where we were and look where we are now. You know, if only we would have listened to God before all this stuff. And then we could have still had that other thing. The first temple had been destroyed 50 years earlier. The Babylonians destroyed it. Okay? Melted the gold off the temple and actually scraped it up out of the bricks that were on the ground and took it with them. Every little bit they could take. Anybody that was 60 years or older at this point would have seen the previous temple. And they would have known about the previous temple. So it didn't even begin to match the splendor. And then the other big thing is the glory of the Lord is not in this temple right now. You know? And why is the glory of the Lord not in this temple? What's not there? The ark's not there. Now, do we know where the ark is at this point? We don't. There are people that say the ark was taken to Babylon. There are Jews in Israel right now that tell you that the ark is still underneath the Temple Mount somewhere, and they know exactly where it is. You know, nobody really knows where the ark was, but it's not here. After they're sent to exile, the ark disappears. And so the idea is that either it was taken or Jews knew they were about to get conquered and they hid it, you know, which probably makes a little more sense to me. I don't have a lot of, you know, support for that. But that's the one that kind of lends itself a little better because we see the ark in Revelation. So it's somewhere. You know, it's not just sitting in a basement somewhere. Somebody knows where it is. It's hidden somewhere, and it's safe. And God's not going to let anybody find it. It's out of there. So what we've got here is no ark, which means no presence of the Lord, no Shekinah glory. Okay? And so this temple is, just off of that, it pales in comparison. Yeah, it's just a building. Now, it could look exactly like Solomon's temple, but God's presence isn't there. Right? Now, don't misunderstand it. It's not that God's not with the people. God is with them. He's telling them to rebuild. He is there. We know God's everywhere. But we know the way the old covenant was set up. There was a holy of holies. There was specific things where God dwelt, and that is not there at this point. And that's why these men are crying. The nation's small and weak. The temple's smaller, less beautiful by far. There's no riches like David and Solomon had. The ark's gone. But the most disappointing thing is God's glory is not there. This God's glory is not present in this temple. And so that's why they're weeping. And yet in verse 12, we've got people shouting for joy. Okay, so it's kind of an interesting sort of picture here. We got older men crying, younger men cheering. So why do you think they're cheering?
They completed something under.
Yeah.
Because there is a temple in there.
Yeah.
They feel like they're coming back to that old age glory.
Yeah, there is something to be joyful about, you know, and especially for these young people that have never seen the old temple. You know, it's not like they had Wikipedia, they could look it up, you know. They didn't have Google Images where they could see what the temple used to look like. Yeah, so from their perspective, hey, we're home, we got a temple again, you know, we've got something to shout for joy here. So for those that didn't have a point of reference or a point of comparison, it's a really great moment. And Psalm 126, a lot of people think that Psalm 126 was written and sung for this actual occasion. And the first four verses say, when the Lord turned again the captivity of Zion, we were like them that dream. Then was our mouth filled with laughter and our tongue with singing. Then said they among the heathen, the Lord had done great things for them. The Lord has done great things for us, whereof we are glad. Turn again our captivity, O Lord, as the streams in the south. So in verse 13, we get the people of Israel. They're accustomed to showing their emotions in visible and audible ways. They were yelling, shouting, crying, laughing, singing type of people. And so this is not out of the ordinary. we know, if you know anything about mourning, when they would mourn, there was an outward show of mourning. You know, we're talking sackcloth, ashes on the head, yelling, screaming, everything. They're wailing, all that kind of stuff. So the same God who had permitted judgment, sent them to exile, had now brought them back, and they would enable them to complete the project. They knew God was with them. They knew there was something good going on here. They knew they were back in the Holy Land. And if you look at the last two verses of 126, Psalm 126, it says, "They that sow in tears shall reap in joy." So we worked in tears. While we were working, we were weeping. But when it's all said and done, we're going to have joy. "He that goes forth and weeps, bears precious seed, shall doubtless come again with rejoicing, bringing his sheaves with him." So the psalm is basically telling, you know, they're singing, this has been tough. It's been hard. We've had adversity. You know, and they're not talking about payday. They're talking about how God is bringing us back. God is redeeming us. And if we think about this in a long-term sort of thing, you know, these Jews that are actually have the true faith in God, you know, do you think they get to this point and they see, all right, well, God's with us, but boy, he's got so much more for us. You know, he's got so much more. Just wait until the future. Wait until what else is going to happen. So we don't have too much time for class discussion. But does anybody have any final thoughts and comments before we close up? What applications can we take? You know, in our state, are we supposed to be weeping? Are we supposed to be shouting for joy? You know, where would we fit into this whole thing? Because we know the same. The good thing, the thing that we have, and they had too, if they really would have been paying attention, is we know that it's going to be better. We know we're not even seeing close to what God's going to have for us in the end. You know, so I think there is some weeping and some joy all at the same time. You know, when you look at this,
each one of us, we look at our lives the same way as the nation of Israel, or at least the Jews, the southern kingdom there, that there is a time when we have sinned, and you know that we were lost, but then we were redeemed in the same way that God brought the Jews back to Jerusalem and allowed them to rebuild the temple, and yet the sin from their the nation, you know, God still loves them, still allows them to serve him. And the same is true with us in our lives. But the sin that we've committed still lessens the potential that God could have used us if we had not been hard-hearted and turned away from him at times in our life prior to that. Yeah. So, you know, there's great joy that God still loves us and he hasn't forsaken us forever. And that he allows us to continue to serve him, but there's still a longing for what could have been.
Yeah, I think what I thought about is, you know, when we get to heaven and, you know, that time when we see, boy, if only we had done this, if only we had been a little more committed at this point in our life. This is, God still saved us. It has nothing to do with our salvation. You know, it has nothing to do with our redemption, but look how this sin got in the way of that. And look how this sin got in the way of that. You know, I think that's where we always have to kind of,
it's almost like when we have the new earth and the new Jerusalem.
Yeah.
You know, this earth would be totally different. It would be amazing. And it's, again, what this could have been like had we not sinned at the very beginning.
Right.
It's what you would
have. Didn't have to go through all that muck between here and there. Yeah, exactly right. All right, well, let me close this in prayer. Heavenly Father, Lord, thank you for this time. Lord, I thank you for this class and for our ability to discuss and fellowship and have this common blood that you've covered us with, Lord. Just gives us that automatic fellowship with you and with each other. Lord, continue to bless us as we go through your word. Be with us as we go. Help us to examine any sin that we might have in our lives, Lord, so that we can serve you better, be more effective for you. Thank you for allowing us to serve you and worship you. Pray again that you get all the glory this week. In Jesus' name, amen. All right, thank you, guys. Yes. Yeah.
All right. I firmly believe that, you know, once the Dome of the Rock is destroyed, the second coming is going to start gathering steam.
Right, definitely. Yeah.
So once that happens, we can look forward to seeing other things occur rapidly.
Yeah, I would imagine. Yeah, that seems to be the
indicator.
The one thing that's standing in the way right now. Yeah,
yeah, exactly.
Because they say they've got priests ready to serve over there, and temple implements ready to go. Yeah, yeah, and getting red heifers ready to go, and all that other kind of stuff. Yeah,
I heard about all that.
Yeah, it's kind of crazy. It's cool stuff.
That's
okay, I got it.
All right.
Not in the store, yeah. So that's when we carried off.
anything else? Or was it carried on fire?
Yeah, that's a good question.
Does it say? Yeah. And did they rebuild another ark?
Yeah, that's super. I never really thought about that.
Is that the same way? I know when they went Solomon, when Solomon brought it in, that not everything was fine. Most of the time, it was no longer there. During the ark.
Yeah, right. Making money off the off the religious relics.
Yeah.
I don't know. That's a very good question.
Ready to the lost ark.
Yeah.
Looking at Egypt because Shishak was
the one
who called it up.
That's really interesting.
So God
didn't
give
us
a historical clue.
Yeah. How about that? Yeah. That's interesting.
Online too much.
I messaged you like a week ago. I did. Not beyond there.
Right, my phone, sometimes it'll give you Facebook stuff right away, and sometimes it doesn't send me.
Oh, I have an air on the table, and I can not take with that because the FBI
will
fly a little bit.
Okay.
And so I didn't know if you guys know one of them. I know they broke the other one.
Yeah, the other one's broken.
I don't know what kind it is, but ours has like. Birthday?
Yes.